We are finishing step one from the steps we took because we covered the big book for the 10th or 11th time up through More About Alcoholism. And so those 43 pages and Doctor's Opinion are designed for us to be able to admit we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives were unmanageable, and to admit complete defeat. And then it gets us ready for the next chapter, which is all about God, we agnostics. And so we covered the first half of this step on from the steps we took. And you can order the book on Amazon, and it's really good. And we also have Carry This Message, and you can get that on Amazon too. Carry This Message was written a few years later than the steps we took, and it's how a sponsoree look at each step with assignments for the sponsor and the sponsoree, and it's really good. We're gonna, when we do step two, we're gonna actually look at Carry This Message. And I can honestly say that I was about 5 years or so going to meetings, and I even started a big book study myself, and it was started in my house. It became the Prince of Peace meeting. But I never really understood the program or the steps till one day, you know, I'm a smart guy, right? Everybody agrees, of course. And I know everything.
Was that funny?
Yes, that was funny. And I know everything, right? And so I went to the Sunday night meeting, and I won. Mike Herman used to make these tapes or cassettes, and we'd have these raffles. And I won this Joe and Charlie Big Book study. And I took it, and I have an exercise bike, and I have a ledge here, and every morning I ride the bike, and I listen to this stuff. And I had the Joe and Charlie CDs there, but, you know, Joe and Charlie from Arkansas, what are they going to teach me? I mean, it sounded like, you know, country, two hillbillies, you know, talking about the steps. There's probably somebody from Arkansas listening, but and of course, you know, being a brilliant alcoholic with old ideas, of course, it just sat there. And then I was listening to this guy Burnsby, who happened to be a doctor, so he was really smart, and he was an alcoholic, and he actually was part of the council on alcoholism. But he was telling his story, and he said he was sober 10 years, and he went to a lot of meetings and, you know, did the best he could. And then one day he listened to Joe and Charlie, and it changed his life. So I'm listening to that, and I'm looking at these CDs right here. I said, Joe and Charlie, and Barnes is a smart guy. And he made everybody listen to Joe and Charlie. So guess what? I changed my mind. And I listened to it, it changed my life. I said, oh my God, I've been to all these meetings and I had no idea what this book was about. I had no idea. Then of course, when Curtis died and I prayed to God how I could make something good out of this, he said to me, you're gonna do Joe and Charlie Big Book style study. And so that people can study the book and they can follow the directions, they don't have to die. And so, and I remember it was in 2011, I was on a cruise, and we were on the Red Sea, and somebody texted me that Charlie had died. And I must admit, I never met him, but he changed my life. Joe had died, I died sooner. He had died earlier than that. And so they've helped so many people. They did 35 big book study weekends for, 25 years, and carried the message. So we are on page 22. And the steps we took is where they just sat with Joe and let him talk about the steps, and then these three people put it together, and it's very well written so that. And Joe, of course, follows the big book in his thoughts. And it says, he's talking about having knowledge, not being able to have all the knowledge possible in the world. At the top, the super brain still would hardly know anything. It would be an enormous relief if we would realize this. Did any of you live where you thought you knew everything? And I knew that Joe and Charlie couldn't help me, right? Of course, right? Anybody have old ideas that were wrong? I still have them. They come up and I say, wow. Now it's fun to see your old ideas, isn't it? This is not to say we should not educate ourselves or learn as much as we can, but we have to realize that we will never be everything or know everything. Humility, right? Who has all knowledge? That one is God. May you find him now, right? When we realize our powerlessness, we can seek a source of power. And so we have to give up that we have the answer or any way to find the answer to our alcoholism and to begin to seek a new source, right? That's why step one comes before step two. Did anybody ever wonder about that? It doesn't start on step two, it starts on step one. Sometimes the answer to our problem lies in the little bit of knowledge we do have, so we go ahead and use it. But often we run into problems completely baffling to us, and then we must admit our powerlessness and turn to a higher power for assistance. Unless we admit I'm powerless, I'm not going to turn anywhere else, right? And in fact, I think that's why alcoholics die, because they admit they're powerless over alcohol, but they don't want to admit that they're powerless to fix their lives. They can't realize that the second part of the first step is powerless to manage your life. They said, our lives were unmanageable. By who? By me. And remember, we're going to write New York in the next book and put those two words in the first step. Our lives were unmanageable by me. My life was unmanageable by me. And when I realized that, then I had to find another way, right? So we need to get this straight. We have the power. We have access to the power to solve any problem. I mean, any problem in our lives. Now, the big book in chapter two says the power is deep down inside of all of us, right? The fundamental idea of God, but we block it out and we don't allow the power to work. And so he's talking about, and remember, on page 45, which we're going to read maybe next week, it says that lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and the power will solve our problems. I don't solve anything in AA. I allow the power to solve my problems. And we have to remember that. We don't solve anything. We allow God to do it by accessing him and working the steps. If we go back to the Serenity Prayer, anybody like the Serenity Prayer? Good. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Now, I always forgot the first five words, because when I would look at a situation, I would have to accept the things I couldn't change and the courage to change the things I could, and I was going to use my wisdom to know the difference. Well, let me tell you, I accepted things I should have changed, and I changed things I should have accepted. The key is God grant me. It's like God save me from being angry. God grant me serenity. Now, serenity to me, and it may be different to you, but serenity means that if I have any situation in which I'm disturbed, then I want God to give me serenity to get undisturbed. Because if I'm disturbed, God can't work. So I want to get undisturbed so I have peace of mind so God can help me see what I need to accept or what I need to change. And I can't get wisdom to know the difference if I'm blocked from God. It's God's wisdom, not mine. And peace of mind, I wrote serenity, peace of mind to see the truth. And I use the Serenity Prayer in my cancer practice. Patients would be faced with situations and they'd want to continue treatment when it was hopeless. And they would come in with handouts, or they were going to go all over and get the secret thing. And I said, well, you know, if I try to change things that I need to accept, I'm going to harm you. If I keep giving you medicine and we're trying to change something that we need to accept, you're just going to get harmed. And they would think about that. And I would say, I could get any drug off the shelf. You want a treatment, I'll give you something. But I know it can't help you. So why can I can't do that. I said, I have to accept that we're powerless over your situation. And then if I explained it that way, you could see they could understand that it wasn't something that they were happy about. But they could see it. And then, of course, if the doctor cares about you and he tells you that it's not a good idea to do more treatment, they can say, well, maybe it's not a good idea. And so it really helped, because the Serenity Prayer applies to everything, doesn't it? And we can put every problem on one side or the other. A situation can either be accepted or it can be changed. And if we're powerless over it, we have to first accept it. Then we could do something about it. Now, remember they used to have page 448 or 49, Ed? And they changed the page in the new edition because they got tired of people quoting that acceptance was the answer to all my problems. Well, the Serenity Prayer doesn't say you should accept everything, right? But what I heard Dr. Paul speak, and what he was saying is, I have to accept things as they are, and then look at it, and then what do I change or what do I accept? And that means I have to get the serenity to accept whatever's happening in my life as it's happening, and then use the Serenity Prayer in God to have the wisdom to know how to react to it. And so if I'm powerless over it, I have to first accept it. Then we could do something about it. But if we have a situation that we need to change and we're trying to accept it, we're just making it worse. And I accepted behaviors in myself, and I accepted things for a long time that I should have changed. And I tried to change things that I needed to accept. Anybody else do that? The most powerful thing I accepted was that moment when I completely understood that I had no power to fix my situation. It was 2:30 in the afternoon, February 8th or something, and I completely accepted that I had no way to fix this. And you know what? It was such a relief. So I got down on my knees and I asked God to help me. I said, I can't do it. I need help. I can't go on anymore. And then my life has changed. Things have gotten better. That's what I call hitting bottom, that moment of accepting my complete defeat over the situation. The greatest truth in the Serenity Prayer is, grant me wisdom to know the difference. And here's the thing. If I try to figure out the wisdom, I'm going to screw it up. The wisdom has to come from God. And we have to understand we're constantly seeking God. So when you have a situation, you go to God first, ask Him for serenity, then have Him give you the wisdom to know what to do. And we talk about that, pause when agitated or doubtful, right, John? And we ask God for the right thought or action. That's really the Serenity Prayer. That's where the Serenity Prayer is in the big book. I think I wrote a thought on that. Somebody might want to read it. I don't know if anybody has, but Stu said it was good. He read it. Anyway, you can tell I'm in a mood. I survived the grandkids and the weekend, and I survived the Chiefs game. We don't mention that. We realize on our own we don't even have that. We don't know which side to put it on. We don't even know whether to accept things or change things, so we ask Him for the wisdom. And so somewhere or other, all of us who are in the recovery process were given the wisdom to take that very first step one. To me, the wisdom to see our situation is the grace of God. It's that moment of truth could come into my mind. God opened my mind enough to see the truth. I think it's a gift. So that's why I'm very anxious when I see new people here that we welcome them, we try to get them connected, because it's a gift when you come to AA. But God can't fix us unless we allow Him to and work the steps. So we can come here, but that won't fix us. We have to work the steps to have the relationship with God, so He allows it. We allow God to change us. And so we accepted the fact that we couldn't change without help, and we asked for the help. So I'm going to ask you, have you asked for help? Now, the other thing about asking for help is, and Sandy Beach makes this point, did you ask for perfect help? Did you ask for 100% help? Or did you really just mean help, but let's not deal with this? Let's just get my life a little bit straightened out, right? And the problem is, when we ask God, we're asking for perfect help. And remember in the, we say the third step prayer, anybody like the third step prayer? It's good, right? Anybody say it? But it says, remember, before you take this step, be certain you're going to abandon yourselves utterly to Him. So we're asking really for 100% help. If you're asking for 99% help, then you're not totally defeated. We need to recall that God's will never enters where self-will dominates. Isn't that the whole deal? We have to go all the time from God's will, from self-will to God's will. How do you know when self-will is dominating you? You don't feel good. You're disturbed. You're angry. How many times have I said that? 8,000? Fear. If you're afraid, you're back in you. If you're angry, you're back in you. You're running the show. And as long as we insist on having our own will, there's no knowledge or concept of God's will. And that's why the next chapter is called We Agnostics. Because agnostic means those without knowledge of God's will. And we lived our whole lives as alcoholics. We may have believed in God or even prayed for God, but we lived our whole lives as if He didn't exist. We were running the show. Anybody do that? And so we had no knowledge of what God could do for us. And so we were agnostics. But then when we work the steps, we have faith and trust in God, and we understand that God can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And that's all the admission of powerlessness is. It is shutting off of self-will in a particular area. Now, how do you know if you're not shutting off self-will in a particular area of your life? You're afraid. If you haven't given money to God, you're worried about money, you're afraid. If you're afraid in some relationship, you haven't given it to God. Anything that you're afraid of in any area of your life, you're still running. Surrender. So notice how he goes from powerlessness to serenity prayer, letting go of self-will to surrender. Surrender usually means admitting we were powerless over this thing. I've often wondered, and I thought I'd write about it, and we can, when we open up, I hope I don't talk too long. Surrender, is surrender really a voluntary act for an alcoholic? Or are we surrendered? See, I was surrendered. I was surrounded by the guns for a long time, and I didn't see them. And until I had that moment when I was surrendered, then I laid down my gun. And that's that moment. And I know Gary talks about that a lot, that moment of complete surrender. Mm-hmm. And we are surrendered, but we see it. We can see the hopelessness and futility of our life as we're living it. And we never want to forget that. You know how you know if you surrendered today? Did you pray this morning? You know, did you meditate? Are you working steps 10 and 11? Are you talking to a sponsor? Are you working with another alcoholic? What are you doing to connect to God? Alcoholics must say, I'm powerless over alcohol. Al-Anons and ACOAs say, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. Well, if you're an alcoholic, you're powerless over people, places, and things. It's all the same deal. And you know, all of us could say, I'm powerless over that obnoxious person at work, which was probably me some days. God, I recorded this. Or over the carburetor of my car. We have to surrender all these things to God. And here's a good one. We have to let go of outcomes. So I surrender a situation, but what does it mean to let go of outcomes? I have to let go of expectations, right? I have to let go of my will, how I see things are going to be done. It's not easy, because sometimes we think we've surrendered and let go of it, but we have a back of our head, we expect a certain thing. And then when we do that, we're actually having God work for us, right? And that'll never work. We work for God. A lot of people see surrender as a weakness, but those of us who had some experience with surrender know that it is the way we get true strength. We talk about that a lot. It says that in the big book, like men of courage, right? When we surrender, we get true strength. Now, what does true strength mean? It means God. So I go from me to God. And all the people who remembered as successful military commanders, for example, had one thing in common. They knew how to surrender or retreat. Custer didn't, and MacArthur did. You know, I'm sure Custer, when he was on the top of that hill, and then all of a sudden he sees 3,000 Indians, he said, but the thing is, and he probably blamed someone right at that moment, mm-hmm. right? But he made a lot of decisions that put him on the top of that hill that day. We've got to learn the value of saying, oh, and the other thing is surrender has to be unconditional. We can't put it down and pick it up. Now, we may do that all day long in step 10, but we're constantly surrendering when we take back and we're practicing our will versus God's will. But I still like the story about the Japanese and the unconditional surrender, and they're on the aircraft carrier, and MacArthur's there, and all the soldiers and everybody's, and the Japanese have their big top hats on, and they go there to sit, and they're going to sign the surrender document. And MacArthur gives the document to the Japanese guy, and he takes his glasses out. And MacArthur says, you don't need to read this. You just need to sign it. This is unconditional surrender. Now, we laugh, but we have to do that initially, unconditionally surrender. And I think that was a gift. I was so lucky that I still want to. And we have to keep the moment of our unconditional surrender alive. We talk about that a lot. Our moment of complete defeat is our moment of unconditional surrender, and keep it alive. We have to learn the value of saying, I don't know, or I made a mistake, or what I've been trying doesn't work. And for alcoholics, that's hard to do. People talk about surrender as if it were a very painful experience. It was very painful not surrendering for all those years. And remember, we can experience a lot of pain. But why did we finally become willing? Because the pain of change was less than the pain of staying the same, right? Did I say it right? Mm-hmm. I think that's true. For example, you know that if you're trying to reason with another human being who doesn't want to hear your reasoning, anybody in a relationship, you're in an impossible situation. And you better just keep your mouth shut. We have a saying, they are who they are, it is what it is. If you could surrender, admit you're powerless, probably in the long run, something is going to bring that person to see the truth. Although conventional wisdom says that admit defeat is some kind of failure, it certainly isn't. In fact, it opens the door to success. If I don't admit the defeat, I'm not open to a different solution, right? And remember, we talk about how honesty, open-minded, and willingness, I have to be honest and see the truth about my situation to be open-minded to a different approach and then be willing to change. And so they talk about the 12 steps as unconventional wisdom. And then he talks about in the next paragraph, what do you want to do if you want to get a new car? Anybody want a new car? Usually you have to say, I go to the banker, I'm going to pick one out. He says, no, it isn't. The first thing you have to do is give up on the old one. Now, it sounds really simple, but that's really so true. Step one opens the door to step two. Remember, each step opens the door to the next step. And you have to take the effectiveness of each step depends on the effectiveness in which you took the step before it. Now, they talk about the prodigal son. And I'm going to write a thought on the prodigal son because it's the whole story of alcoholism. The prodigal son let self-will run the show. It's in the book of Luke. It's a parable that Jesus told. And the prodigal son wanted his inheritance, and he wanted to take it before dad died, which was unheard of in those days. But he said, give me mine. Any alcoholic say, give me mine. And he went out and he spent his money on wine, woman, and song, and then he got into trouble. And so he ends up eating the husks off the corn with the hogs. So it didn't work out well for him. Now, he made a lot of decisions, right? And he's in the pig pen. Now, for a Jewish guy, being in the pig pen in Egypt was not a good situation. But he kept staying there. And he said, this ain't so bad. my shit will probably come in next week or things will get better somehow, right? But somehow he was given a moment of truth. So he had been in the hog pen for a long time. But one day he said it, no doubt from God, he had that moment of truth, and that's what happens to us as alcoholics. He became able to see reality, and he says, look, I'm in the hog pen. There's probably some other guy standing nearby who said, hell man, you've been there 6 months. But he didn't know he was down there until he had a moment of reality. It's a moment of reality. And remember, it says, there are those who cannot or will not do this simple program. They are people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They could not have that moment of reality. As soon as he did, he said, the servants at my father's house are eating better than I am. As soon as he had this moment of reality, as soon as he was able to see the truth, he was able to make a decision to give up his self-will. And he goes back to Dad. Now here's the powerful part of this for every alcoholic. He turned away from himself. He turned towards his father. And as he's turning and going, he's preparing the speech for Dad that he just let me be a servant. I'll be glad to be a servant. I'm sorry what I did. But Dad's running to him. As soon as we turn away from ourselves, God's running to us with open arms. And isn't that what the steps are all about? God can and will if we seek him. And everything was restored to him. And we heard about two people tonight who've been restored. One of the things we can't see when we're blocked off reality is what our problem is. Millions of people before us have solved the same problem. The first step is really much like the first verse of the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor in spirit, those who can admit they were powerless and need the help of God and other people, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I've studied this, and blessed are the poor in spirit means that you have the humility to see your situation, how on your own, without God, you're lost. And it's the beginning of humility. If we want something fixed this way, I wrote my way, we're going to see it this way. We won't see the other possibilities. When the opportunity to fix thing another way comes open, we won't recognize it. Isn't this true? Have you ever worked with an alcoholic? They try to close their mind sometimes and they're not open. What does it say? We have to be willing to go to any length, right? We have to let go of our old ideas completely. We have to be completely willing to follow directions, and they can't be mine. In other words, when we tell God how we want something fixed, we really haven't given up or turned the problem overall. And then we'll close with this. Often the solutions to problems are beyond our imagination. Everything in my life, my work, who I am, everything has been built on what I thought was the worst thing in my life, my alcoholism. When I surrendered to that, my life changed in ways that I could never have imagined. There's a powerful paragraph on page 100. Whenever I get a little down, a little self-pity, we get that as alcoholics. Anybody ever get that? I just look at page 100. It says, when we look back, the things that happened when I put myself in God's hands were better than anything I could have imagined. And if you're alive today and in this room, your life is better than you could have ever imagined. We're all lucky to be alive today and in this room in AA. It's a gift. And it says this step has to be taken 100% every day and every minute. All the others, and if you get away from your first step, you start drifting away from God and the solution. Now, how do you know when you're getting away from your first step? You're not working the other steps. How can you tell if a new person's taken step one? They're doing their fourth step. They've done their third step. They've made a decision. They're doing the work. They're following directions. And it says, it's like damming up water. If you dam it up 99%, the dam will break. But if the water is dammed up 100%, it will be forced to seek another way out. The first step is about surrender, the surrender involved in facing the truth. Father John So says that step one is the only non-spiritual step. We have to make it alone. But I believe the ability to make it is a grace, which I believe, because there are too many people who die without ever making it. It's about finally facing the truth. And the Bible says, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. In step one, we are just about to begin getting free. And I think we should take a moment to think, everybody in this room, how God has come and given us a moment of truth even to be here tonight. And so if you doubt that God loves you or wants you to be close to Him, just think about that. Anyway, we got some time, and we'll open it up, and I hope you got something out of this. Thank you.